Can you tell by talking to people, like, ooh, that person has a tendency to...
Katie's a serial killer.
Yeah, like, oh, like, I'm going to be... I have a tendency to, like, kill, or, you know, Jaquetta is, like...
I like to maim, yeah. Not kill.
Welcome to Hey You Know It. My name's Jaquetta Sotmar, and I'm here with my co-host,
Katie Kazmir. Hey You Know It is a podcast that tells you how it is... or how it should be.
You can listen to Hey You Know It on iTunes, a new episode every Monday.
And here they are, Jaquetta and Katie.
So okay. we're really excited today to have in the Hey You Know It studio Dr. Jacqueline Simon Gunn and Carlo DiCarlo. They're the co-authors of the soon-to-be-released Bear Psychotherapy Stripped, which Katie and I have been reading and quite enjoying.
It's
so
amazing.
Welcome to the studio.
Yes. Thank you for having us.
Thanks
it
for coming in.
It actually should be released. It should be out now.
Okay, so it should be out by now. All right, so then I'll edit that in.
Cool.
Oh.
Yes. So, you want to go start off?
Well, I started reading it. This book is amazing. This is, you have what, five different, well, tell us a little bit about it. You have five different clients that you have.
There's more than five.
More than five?
Yeah, and there's, I mean, there are probably about...
maybe 12?
Yeah, maybe 12. But taking up different amounts of the book. Some take up large amounts of the book, and some you only have in a couple of chapters. So shorter.
Right.
It's shorter stories.
The interesting thing about the book is that it, as opposed to handling case studies individually, chapter by chapter, it really follows Jackie chronologically over the course of 9 years. And so some of the patients are, a couple of the patients are in the book for the entire book, and others come in and out as the chapters go along. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's been a case study book that has done that before.
So
the other thing is that this book reads like fiction.
That's what I was going to say. How does a case study book read?
Chapter by chapter.
And each chapter is dealing with just one person.
Yes.
What I like about this is that you you talk about your feelings as well, which is different. I mean, I'm a big fan of therapy. I've been in therapy forever, and I always wonder what the therapist is thinking while I'm in the session. So with this book, you actually get a little bit of that as well, which kind of humanizes it. I don't know. I think it's, I don't know. It is like a fiction.
So how long have you been in practice?
I've been practicing for 20 years, but... I've had my license for 11 years.
Oh, okay.
So as a licensed clinician, 11 years, but during the course of training, you are always working.
Yeah.
So overall, 20 years of experience.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's
awesome. Really
amazing. How did you get into, or why did you decide to go into psychotherapy?
I think it was my fascination with human behavior, and so I studied psychology in college, and then... did two master's degrees and in psychology, and then after getting the master's degrees, I thought I'd go for my doctorate, but I decided to take 2 years off before I went for my doctorate. And at that time, I thought maybe research and academics, because I was very interested in the theories of psychology, until I started working with patients. And I just love the experience of the psychotherapeutic relationship and hearing people's stories and seeing how the relationship would evolve and how people got better.
But your first master's is in forensic psychology.
Yeah, my first master's in forensic.
That's fascinating.
Wow. Yeah, so I wanted to be an FBI profiler.
Ooh, yeah.
And I went to John Jay College of Criminal Justice right
just
out of college.
John Jay
and I did forensic psych. And then while I was there, I started working with a professor. He was actually a professor of statistics, and he really dissuaded me from going into the law enforcement end. He really encouraged me. He thought that I could do more on if I had gone into the psychology end. And maybe that dissuaded me a little, but what really dissuaded me was when they started talking about the lifestyle of people that are in the FBI. It's not just that. Well, first of all, I think I'm too anxious to pack a gun or to decoy in a situation. That made me nervous. But what bothered me even more was that there's like a conventionalism within that type of place, which wouldn't have fit my personality. If they did take me, it wouldn't have fit my personality. Like, I think I would have had, because I'm very artsy and I don't know that I would have, I don't think I would have been happy in the long run, but I'm completely fascinated by the criminal mind and how things can just go wrong.
And so with your fascination with that, can you tell by talking to people like, ooh, that person has a tendency
Katie's
to...
a serial killer.
Yeah, like, oh, like I'm going to be, I have a tendency to like kill or, you know, Jaquetta is like...
I like to maim, not kill.
Do you ever find that talking to people, you're like, wait a minute, something is terribly wrong with them.
Yes. Yes, but I wouldn't necessarily... I mean, I think that's the interesting thing about criminality. There's so many variations. I mean, they like to lump people in, like, one category, but I've worked with murderers and rapists and, you know, armed robbery and things like that, and you see that there's a spectrum of reasons why criminality happens. So you have someone who has no history of criminality, and then they snap for some reason, and then you have the more
like an oxygen
methodical, compulsive serial killer type. So I mean, I can. There are times when I mean, I'm in private practice now, so I don't experience this as often, but or even out in the world, where I would have this feeling that something was off and that it could fall into that range of someone being dangerous, but I might not know exactly in what way unless I perform an inquiry.
Okay.
Like if they came in to see me.
And I think that's fascinating. I would definitely then bring you any people I was dating.
Right
away to be like, hey, just have a quick look at them.
Yeah, I wasn't good at that when I was dating, but I could probably
for someone else.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. So I can understand that. So you moved away from that, and then you started going into the type of therapy that you're doing now.
I didn't move away. I mean, it took me a long, because I moved away from going into criminal profiling in the FBI, but the beginning of my training for the first 10 years, let's say, of working, maybe it's like 8 years, I was working with a criminal population as a psychotherapist. So I worked in halfway house type rehabs for court stipulated felons who also had an addiction. And then I worked in a hospital for the criminally insane, which was the most outrageous experience.
Really?
Oh. Well, it was a maximum security prison, but the prisoners were not just first-degree felons. They also had mental illness, so they were in either insanity plea acquittals or they were incompetent to stand trial. So I couldn't wear open... I was in Miami at the time, which is hot all the time. I couldn't wear open-toed shoes just in case I had to run down the hall.
No.
What?
Yeah.
So that was part of the protocol. You had to dress a certain way.
And you were a marathon runner, so.
Yeah.
Good luck to
which
that.
Which is good, yeah. Well, I remember one day I had gone in because I slept over someone's house, and I didn't have my closed-toe shoes because in Miami, like, I only had closed-toe shoes because I bought them for that job because it's so hot you don't wear closed-toe shoes. I mean, men might, but...
Yeah.
So I had the open-toe shoes. They were black, and so I tried to be conspicuous. I put black socks or inconspicuous, and I put black socks under the shoes, and they caught me going in when I was checking in, and they were like, the tall, thin one downstairs, it doesn't have the right shoes on, and so they weren't going to let me in. Until the secretary came down with this, like, extra pair of black closed-toe shoes that barely fit, and then they let me in.
Really?
So how is that? How is an ill-fitting shoe safer for running away from a criminally insane person than an open-toed shoe?
And what else do they tell you that you have to do to protect yourself in that situation? I mean, they're watching, so.
Yeah, there were guards and everything was, I mean, it was, I honestly never felt unsafe, you know, so, because if I felt that unsafe, I wouldn't have tried to sneak in with the open-toe shoes.
Yeah.
but yeah, I mean, it was a maximum security prison. I mean, when I went into the elevator, I was working on the fifth floor. I couldn't press 5 and go up to 5. Instead, I had to stand in front of a camera, identify who I was, and I had a badge that had to be shown to the camera just in order to transport myself. The only time I guess I was at risk was when I was running groups or if I was doing individual therapy, when they would let the patients or inmates out and they would be in the room
group,
with us.
Group,
I mean, there would be like corrections officers around, but they weren't locked up, and there was some crazy, I mean, riots broke out. One time this very large man got very upset, and he picked up a huge garbage can, and he just started thrashing it all around.
Oh, wow.
I mean...
So that must be something, doing therapy like that with people who are so violent, and then getting them to talk about their emotions and
I think in group,
and everybody hearing each other's stories.
It's not good. I mean, that's it's not. I mean, that's eventually what led me out of forensic. I mean, that's the thing. I've never stopped being fascinated by it. But what I realized is that the type of therapy I wanted to do, you can't do.
Okay.
With that kind of population, because they can't form a therapeutic relationship, and you know, quite honestly, a lot of them don't want to. They don't even want the therapy. That particular job, my job wasn't necessarily to rehabilitate them, though, which I did. And there's a story in Bear Psychotherapy Stripped about a boy named Ralph that I worked with in a juvenile detention center, where I have more of a conventional therapy relationship, and my goal was to help him.
This is a young man.
Young, like 16-year-old boy at the time, 16. And but in the hospital for the criminally insane, it was more about restoring people that were not competent to stand trial, restoring competency. So we ran competency groups, which is to try to help people understand. You can't, a defendant is not allowed, they're protected by our constitution. You can't have someone be in a trial if they're not competent to understand that they're being accused of something and that they are participating in their defense. So that's the thing. If someone has a severe mental illness, sometimes they can't understand, what is the lawyer doing there? Is the lawyer's working for me? I'm a defendant, and they can't participate in that. So part of the job I had at this particular place was to help restore competency and write competency evaluations for the court to either argue why the person still wasn't competent or to say that competency had been restored. And then with the insanity plea acquittals, they were people who had already been acquitted and had gotten off. Well, it's not really getting off. That's a misunderstanding. They are guilty by reason of insanity. So instead of going into prison, they go into a forensic hospital, which is basically like a prison, except it is, maybe there's a little more focus on rehabilitation and definitely on psychiatric treatment. And, you know, you can't really do therapy with people like that because they're really disturbed.
Okay. I see.
Now, sometimes they let people up on the insanity plea that are very disturbed in their violence, but they don't have like a thought disturbance. So you probably would be able to have a conversation, like Ted Bundy you could have probably had a fabulous conversation with him, but you wouldn't have been able to help him. He wouldn't have gotten off on the insanity plea anyway, because the insanity plea is the legal definition, not psychiatric, and he knew what he was doing, and because he knew what he was doing, he wouldn't have been legally insane.
That's fascinating. So you guys met in Miami, and
we met in New Jersey.
She wants to go, she's going for her third...
No, for my doctorate.
Right, for your doctorate.
I feel undereducated all of a sudden.
I know. I feel like
with my paltry master's in teaching.
For her second master's, she went to Pittsburgh. And when she decided she was going away again, she didn't want to go away by herself again. She wants some company, and it was between San Francisco and Miami. And I had had it with the winter. So I said, well, you know what?
I need a change.
So if you go to Miami,
I'll go.
But we have to live in South Beach. And she ended up choosing the school in Miami. So we went to Miami.
And lived on South Beach.
How
was that? Yes. Back then, it must have been a lot better than it is now.
I loved it.
It was great. I loved it. I mean, I loved living in Miami. Working wasn't always the...
Who likes to work, though?
Exactly.
Well, no, but I mean,
but it's like, it's
no
tough.
One works in Miami.
Yeah, there are a lot of... I don't want to be too general, but there were a lot of shady people in Miami, and it was tough to get things done because there was just...
Too much shade.
Yeah. Too much shade. A lot of bullshitting going on.
Just living on South Beach and being in the bodegas, or like on the rare occasion when I'd be in a club, I had seen things in Miami that I have never seen in my life, and I grew up 4 miles from Manhattan.
That's hard for me to believe. Because I feel like in New York, you just see it all.
Right, that's exactly how I felt, like, growing up with a fake ID.
Yeah,
because
you're over
it by
the time you're 18.
No, nothing. New York City is conservative compared to South Beach. I mean, this is like anything goes, crazy,
wild. At least at the time. I'm not really sure how it is now.
It's probably worse.
It might be worse. But they've really corporatized everything down there, too, so I don't know.
How did you get the idea to write this book in this way? Had you read a lot of other books and thought there's a better way to do this, or did you just want to tell your story in a more creative and...
Well, I think that that was Carlos.
You wrote a book a few years...
In 2010.
Before that. Okay. A couple years before that. Which had the same basis in that she wanted to talk about what her, it was called in a therapist chair, and she wanted to talk about what was going on in her mind during therapy, and
their stories,
and it's really a fascinating read, and I think you wanted to expand on that, and she came to me and she's like I wasn't really happy after, now that it's been out for a while, I feel like I could have done something more better. Maybe. Like had it edited differently, so she'd asked me to edit the book. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, well, send me a sample chapter. So she sent me like maybe a third of the largest case study of Tess. And
Tess.
Fascinating.
People, if you read when you read the book, the first part of the book, you get introduced to a character called Tess or Contessa, and this character is just fascinating. I feel like I've seen this woman a couple of times in New York, or that type of person.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And to get underneath and to see what's really going on.
Yeah, and to hear what the therapist is thinking at the same time. Yeah. It's fascinating as well. So anyway.
You know, edited a sample, the one piece of the chapter, and with a case study, and I did a little bit of rewriting, and she really liked it, and she liked the ideas, and I said, you know, I have more ideas about how you can do the book differently, and which was to do it to do it chronologically, mm-hmm. and to really write it as though it almost as like it would read like fiction. And to really delve a little more into the cases, expand some of the cases, not have shorter cases, which is in the therapist chair, but really get in deep. And then she asked me to instead of edit it to co-write it with her.
Awesome,
that's great. So
well, the book definitely reads better because of the novelized format, and it even has a climax. Like a fiction book where everything sort of
is
coming to
Tess?
A head at once, and
it is with Tess.
She explode into a hail of pearls all over the place.
Not quite.
That's what I.
But it's close.
Really,
it's more like a shower of Nivea skin cream.
Oh, really?
Oh no!
I'm kidding.
I just like the character. It's such a New York woman. This like, little tiny, she, you know.
She's simultaneously sympathetic and grating.
Yeah.
But
that's
you
the perfect
can't help
character.
Yeah,
that's
perfect.
Yeah.
Those are the things that you need for a character. You need them to have a fault. You need them to have an endearing quality.
Yeah, some charm.
Yeah.
So that you're not repelled. It's like, but it's also that morbid curiosity. Like I said, I'm just in maybe like a quarter of the way through it. I'm like, ooh, whatever happens to her, I want to know.
I know. I was thinking the same thing. We got a copy of the book just a few days ago, and we're like, I wish I didn't go to work one day I could read the whole thing.
Wait until you get to the case with Tony.
Oh no.
Okay. Tony's a real treat.
These are all true stories, but there are, some characters are an amalgam of different characters together.
Well, in order to protect patient privacy, there's various ways to do that. One is, like, for example, in the case of Tess, there's very little fictional details in that case because she signed a consent form.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow.
In fact,
she
was upset that she wasn't in the first book. She didn't think, you've read the very beginning. She brought up later that she felt I didn't want to put her in the therapist chair because she wasn't interesting enough.
Huh? I love her. You, Tess, if you're listening. Let's have lunch.
Yes.
White wine.
So all the characters, either there's a consent form or you completely protect them. So there is no danger for anybody. There's no confidentiality that has been breached with anybody.
Right.
Everybody's protected. And then as far as you go, that's your choice in what you're revealing about your own thoughts and feelings.
Right. I mean, my story is true, but I don't have to worry about my own confidentiality, only to the extent of like what is going to come at me from the profession, other professionals or whatever. I mean, but to answer your question, because I think it is an important one, that there are some of the stories are amalgamates of a few different, I mean, it's done in various ways, like it could be amalgamate of like three or four different patients together, or sometimes what we do is take a story that's true and make the people in the story different than the people who it actually happened to.
Okay.
But some of them I did have consent forms, and so they're...
But just to clarify, even the ones who signed consent forms, their names have changed too.
Yeah, okay. Their names have changed.
Damn you, Tess. I must find you. So in writing this, in this book, so definitely you're dealing with the patients, or this kind of, you know, putting the patient stories together. Did you discover anything about yourself when you were doing this? Because there's a lot of you kind of analyzing your own feelings while dealing with the patients.
Yeah, a lot of things that have to go into another book. You know what I mean? That we were talking about that earlier, that might, I'm not sure how that will be published, but I think what I learned was that there was a lot to tell that I didn't think I could put necessarily in this type of book, if that makes sense, because I feel like the book reads like fiction. I mean, the book is so exciting to me that when I read it and I get halfway through, I'm like either crying or wondering what's going to happen, and we wrote it, so I know what's going to happen. But there are allusions to parts of my life that I probably would have maybe even been helpful to the readers if I had gotten more into it. But because the book is written from Jackie the psychologist, not Jackie the novelist, I felt like I mean...
You had to draw a line.
I had to draw a
line.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think the original purpose of the book, like in The Therapist Chair, is different than the outcome. And what the vision for the book is now. And so in the beginning, it starts out in my process. I don't mean the book itself. It starts out as more of a teaching tool for people in the field, or interested lay people, or patients, like mm-hmm. other people who are either in therapy or thinking about going into therapy, so that A, they understand what happens and the complexity of what happens, and also that the honesty of the book, there's a purpose to that, because we're in a field where there's actually a level of conservatism that feels very inauthentic to me. And I think the purpose of writing in The Therapist Chair, and especially Bear, is to say this isn't really how it is. When they talk about how it is, or they depict it on TV, this is a difficult, complicated, rich, and exciting process that has all these layers, and it can be very unpredictable. And I want my readers to understand that this isn't a scientific formula. I'm not a medical doctor, and even in medicine you need creativity, but it doesn't have, I have a headache, take an aspirin kind of method to it, but rather it's about being open and hearing people's stories and empathizing and not knowing what's going to happen, which how Carlo formatted the book really gives a reader that feeling. Like, you know how you're saying, I want to know what happens with Tess?
Yeah.
I feel like that. Like, yeah. Each session, I'm like, wow, and you wouldn't believe the things that could happen within, like, 3 days in someone's life. And so I'm left over the cliffhanger, and I'm waiting for the next session. And in between the sessions, I have all these thoughts about how I can help her, but also what is she going to come in with?
Because maybe it's going to be a totally different test.
And it happens all the time. I mean, right, like, I mean, the stories of people's lives that can, especially like, for example, Tess comes twice a week, but with a once a week patient, the things that can take place in a person's life in 1 week, you have no idea. And that's, you know, sort of like the fact is stranger than fiction thing is something you definitely know as a therapist. So I'm hoping through stripping down the therapy relationship, my thought process and other people's lives, that people can identify with the characters in the stories and find something of themselves that brings them some kind of inspiration or hope or healing in their own life. So in that way, it's a non-self-help, self-help book.
Okay.
I like it already. So,
yeah.
I hate self-help
And it's
books,
not there
sorry.
for, since it's not sensational, it's not a scandal, it's not, yeah. It's not like, this is a juicy book about these people and their lives. It's really very
it's
rich.
It's Bear. That's literally the title of the book. It's Bear, stripped down to the bones, and it really, you know, will hopefully give people insight into themselves as they're reading it. Without being preachy, just by giving insight into into these other patients.
Mm-hmm. I really like it because, like I said, I don't like self-help books at all. Like, they really turn me off, just the tone of them, the way that they're put together. But if things were more in this format, I would be more open-minded to them, to get, you know, learning something from this as opposed to, you know, women who do this and then this happens to them.
Yeah, here's the steps that you need to follow, and if you don't follow them, then, you know, it's going
to
fall apart.
Those are great when you're trying to do, when you're trying to accomplish something, like, you know, start a business or, you know,
cut and dry.
learn how to figure out how to get a job or move into some kind of new industry. But sometimes self-help books can be a little, I don't want to say dogmatic, but a little...
It's like a formula.
It could be inauthentic. Yeah, because it is. It's very formulaic when you're trying to improve yourself. You know, every person is different. You can't...
There's like something that bothers me is that there is a superficiality in the way that we're forced to relate as we go about in our world that does not exist in the therapy relationship, which is probably one of the main things that drew me into psychotherapy when I started doing it in the first place, that I could maintain authentic relationships with people where we were being real with each other. And I think that in Bear, my hope is that by seeing the whole person like you do as a therapist, that people will, that the humanity of the person will appeal to the reader, and that will allow the reader to embrace their own humanity rather than hiding from it. So like we see with Tess, she's aging.
As
we are all aging.
Yeah.
You know, I'm younger than Tess, but I'm aging too. And so I think there's something about her aging process that I'm privy to as I'm listening to her story that can help people if they read her story, that they can empathize with what she's going through and hopefully find something of themselves, cling on to it, and then find a way to live better as a result of it. That's what I mean. I mean, that's not really self-help, because self-help books are like, how to not age, or like, how to, you know what I mean?
Have
10 steps to keep yourself looking young. I'm not like,
how to fight all these things, these insecurities, these things that you perceive as an insecurity, or any faults or failings that you have, and how to fight it and how to be better and to shove that all aside, rather than just say, well, why don't you look at it, and maybe it's not as bad as you think, or it is bad, and so what?
Or maybe we're all going through the exact same thing, and if we all just admitted that aging is really hard and we could actually talk about it, we wouldn't all have to be struggling so much to fight against it, because it's human to age. There's no shame in it, you know?
We all have to deal with our own immortality, or mortality, definitely.
That was a nice phrase.
What are some negative stereotypes that you think that the media is putting out there about therapy and psychotherapy?
I think the stereotype can be true for certain therapists too. It's not true for me, and it's not true for a lot of therapists that I know. But that there's this like sterileness to the relationship, and that it is not collaborative, but it's hierarchical, so that it has a sterile doctor-patient feel to it, that the therapist is not engaged or invested in the story, but rather is like sitting back and taking notes and observing rather than participating. That never felt right to me, and I wouldn't want to be in a therapy as a patient like that. I mean, some people feel safer like that. But, I mean, for example, one thing it's funny because it is true, but it gets violated all the time, is the ending of the session hour. I mean, there has to be a beginning and an end to a session, just because, like, seriously, they could go on. I mean, we could be in therapy for years, nonstop, nap breaks, but like, if you set the session for 50 minutes, it's supposed to start on time, with, you know, if both of you are on time, and end after 50 minutes. Now, there's a reason why that happens, because we do need, as therapists, to be able to schedule other patients and have an idea of what our day is going to be like. When you see it on TV, you can have a patient that's hysterical crying on the floor, and then the doctor's And it's funny when you see it on TV, and I'm not saying that that doesn't happen. Sometimes patients don't cry to the end of the session because they're too afraid of what's coming up, and you need to end the session because you're protecting them from being overwhelmed by feelings. But more often than not, if someone has come in and they're dealing with something that's really difficult and it's been a trying session and it goes over five, like I'll say at 50 minutes, we do need to stop, but I want to make sure you're okay before you leave. I'll keep them five more minutes to make sure they're okay before they leave. And so that's one stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
So I schedule on the hour, so I have that 10 minutes latitude.
That's a good idea. Yeah. I always wonder about that. Because you've seen Dr. Katz with the patients in the middle, and it's like, da-da-da. Oh, you hear the music. Time to go. It's like, doesn't matter what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, they've got to move it out. I got someone else coming in.
Yeah, that feels like a factory to me. I mean, it just feels like I'm not dealing with a human being. I mean, that's the other, you know, I expect from a patient to eventually be able to come in and tell me things that they don't, that they're not comfortable with or that are scary. And I mean, if I'm expecting that of them, then they have a right to expect to have a therapist that's invested in their life story and helping them get better. And sometimes that involves going over a session hour. I mean, sometimes it involves things you never thought you'd do. Like one day I had to move a patient's car because no one in his, he had a situation where he had to take himself into the hospital for medical reasons, and he parked his car on the street and he went into the ER, and the ER said, I literally thought he was dying. He was taken in. They admitted him.
Yeah.
And his car was on the Upper East Side on the street and was going to be towed. And because of complicated family dynamics, no one in his family would come move his car, which then would have been towed.
And so with a huge fine.
Too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
To get that back. And where you have to go to get the car.
You gotta go like Javits.
Later that day, I found myself in a pouring rainstorm on the Upper East Side searching for a car that I had never seen before so that I could move it into the parking lot of the hospital he was at, and I did do that. I don't know how I found a car.
Well, I think that was very nice of you. I mean, but you end up doing these things because
sometimes
part of
well, if you're part of the care. Person is in your life and you have a relationship with them,
right.
It must be difficult to be
But that's also a normal thing for anybody, no matter
like a human being. Yeah.
Like on the subway, if somebody falls, you know, down or starts passing out, you may stay with them and hold their head so they're not, you know.
Carla's like, maybe.
Depends upon what time the
movie is. Is it the A train? Because I need to get to work.
Yeah, you know, you don't expect to do these things, but yeah, that's more of a human reaction.
But I think the stereotype, and I think there are a lot of therapists who would disagree with me, which is why the book is rather edgy as it is, without having added more stuff, is that there needs to be boundaries and limits to the relationship as well. And so there are a lot of therapists that wouldn't have did what I did.
Yeah.
And I might not have done it with a different patient. With this particular patient, I felt that it was the right thing to do. But I mean, that's what makes it so complicated. There is a very human component and there is a very personal investment, and yet it's still a professional relationship. And that's, I mean, I'm not sure if that comes across in the book, but where I'm constantly trying to figure that balance out.
I think it's maybe analogous to the relationship between like teacher and student, where there has to be some kind of emotional attachment to the students. But at a certain point, you kind of have to set a line of like, well, I'm not a family member. I'm not, you know, you don't want to go too far with it so that they become dependent upon you. I wanted to ask, do patients fall in love with their therapist as often as they do?
Yeah, you hear about
films?
That all the time.
Yeah.
They're always having like an affair. They're falling in love.
Yeah, they become, like, you know, enamored with
therapists. I have yet to fall in love with a therapist of mine.
Me either. I'm not, like, once the session's over, I'm like, see ya.
Yeah.
You know? Like, if I see them on the street, I might say hello. Not for too long.
I saw my primary care physician on the street. I was like, hi. And she's looked at me. She didn't recognize me.
Yeah, I've run from a foot doctor before. I'll just put that out there.
Your foot doctor did a good job.
Yes. We've talked about this foot doctor before. He was very friendly with my foot.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel comfortable seeing him with sandals outside.
So patients really fall in love?
I think that's a complicated question. Of course, I think that patients could potentially fall into a real in love state with a therapist, but more of what I've seen in my experience is that something can evolve within the relationship that feels like love, but it usually means something else. Like, it could mean that needs weren't met. Like, for example, I mean, being a therapist, someone is being very nurtured, and if you have a patient who's not really been nurtured, if that was very absent in their childhood, the feeling of being nurtured and accepted can create a situation where they actually feel like they're in love, but what they're really feeling is cared about and nurtured, and
they don't recognize that that's
what
that is.
Right, they can't recognize that that's what the attachment is. So what happens is they come in with feelings like that. If they're able to share it with you, which they aren't always able to share it with you, sometimes you sense it and it's not in the room, but in words, you can process it together so that they can come to an understanding of what that means, and then you can help them find that in their outside relationships, mm-hmm. and then it diffuses that feeling of being in love with the therapist in the room.
So what about the therapist? Do you get to see a therapist as a therapist?
I think you're supposed to.
So once you've gotten your license, everything, you can continue to see a therapist?
Oh, I mean, in terms of having the choice to go to therapy, you always have that choice, but certainly it's highly encouraged and it's sort of looked down upon if you've not ever been in therapy before. They really want therapists to go to their own therapy and see their own therapist. It's a really important part of the learning process to have a better understanding of yourself and your reactions to who you are.
It's like a personal trainer not working out.
Yeah,
right.
I'd love to see that book though, like therapists on therapists on therapists.
Yeah.
You know, like what's the therapist who's giving therapy to the therapist? Like what's going on with that
right.
person?
So
that's
advice
like a master.
Advice, except it's therapist on therapist.
Yeah. therapist. Right. But that's like a master therapist, right? If you're a therapist for therapists, you got to be like all on top of your game. I would hope.
I mean, the issues are pretty much the same.
That's like Jack Reacher, because he was a military cop.
Who's Jack Reacher?
Tom Cruise, right?
Tom Cruise.
I'm like, it's a fictional character.
It's a fictional character. He is a military cop, so he has to be...
He's a cop of cops.
Of cops, yeah.
Okay, like internal affairs kind of thing.
So he has to be super fit.
Yeah, the IAB of therapy.
They always have Tom Cruise running. I feel like that's his, like...
Now his new movie, he gets killed in every scene and comes back. He needs to stop.
Every scene ends with his death.
Yes. He needs to be in therapy. There's something going on where every... It's a new soldier movie. He does run, you're correct, a lot. And then he gets killed.
Running.
Then he's up again running and getting killed again. Repeatedly.
Yes. Very interesting.
He can't stop. Yeah.
I actually heard that it's a good movie.
Really?
Yeah.
You like everything, though.
I don't know. No, I'm saying I read... Like, no, if I read that it was a bad movie, I would have said it was a bad movie. I'm saying I read that it's getting
good
reviews.
He's a Netflix for me.
But
I can't pay for
Cruise. The Cruise is still out, I guess. I don't know.
So, are there any plans to turn this into anything like a TV show or film? Because I would love to see Tess.
I would love to see this.
Yes. I think
like
you could play
HBO
Tess.
Series.
Katie could be
Tess.
Be Tess.
Yes.
Well,
me too.
We
could alternate.
Oh, that would be interesting.
Yes.
You have like
Why
Tess
not?
Before and Tess after.
Yes.
Like Tess, like reflecting on Tess.
She started off as
Tess on Tess.
As a black woman by the end. She's a blonde.
That's right.
Yeah, she's a Polish woman by the end. That's her journey from African American to Polish. It's like, hey, you know it kind of character.
Yeah. Well, don't we have a little bit of each in us, you know?
I have a little Polish in me. Or I will.
Or you've had.
Or I've had, yeah. You don't know my life.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the stories in Bear is, I've already written a first draft of a screenplay based on Tony.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You might have seen
I've
it.
Heard about this. It's going around. That screenplay is making the rounds.
Okay.
Everyone's
and,
talking about it.
And then we'll see. We were thinking that maybe we might do something with it.
That would be amazing.
But Tony's story definitely would make a great...
So can you give us a little background, without giving, no spoiler alerts, but give us a little something on Tony so people know what they're in for.
On Tony, you want to talk about it or do you want me to?
I talk too much, you probably... I know, I'm a talking therapist. Yeah. When you listen all day and then someone asks you a question, it's so exciting because you get to talk.
It's your chance.
Tony comes to to Jackie because he feels that he's reached an age where he needs to figure out why he hasn't settled down.
Okay, I have a clue to that for him.
you already know.
I think I might know.
Yeah. Well, keep it to yourself.
Okay.
As his therapy goes on, we discover that there are a lot of reasons why Tony is 36, I think, when he first starts therapy, why he is 36 and a single serial dater.
Okay.
And they are all, there are a number of reasons, and they all are
shocking.
Are shocking, and they they become progressively more dangerous in some ways, honest in other ways, but not as much from Tony. It's hard to give away too much of Tony's story.
You have to read the book.
Yeah,
you have to
read
setting them up for.
And the book is bare.
Yeah,
psychotherapy strip.
I like it on the cover. There's a very stylish chair with just a little piece of fabric coming off of it.
My husband did that.
I like it. It's very effective.
Yeah, he's a visual artist.
Awesome. So, what are some of the other? So, we talked about Tess. We talked a little bit about Tony. What are some of the other characters, like briefly, that people will encounter?
We have an Olympiad, who comes to Jackie because she is, she's got eating issues.
Okay.
She's,
performance and eating issues. Very close to the Olympics.
Very close.
Wow.
So Jackie helps. She's.
She's a track runner.
Yeah. She's like. She's not eating as much as she should be.
Okay.
For various reasons, which we learn. And Jackie helps her through that to get back, to get herself back in shape in order to make the Olympic trials.
Okay.
What's one of your other favorites?
I think Ralph's my favorite, but I was going to talk about, there's a lot of stories about working women, prostitutes, and various different reasons why they
sex workers.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's various different stories about sex workers, and so in that case, not only do we have various stories about the therapy relationship, but also the larger social issues that I have taken issue with on myself, which is that there is a stigma associated with prostitution that I don't agree with. So there's a lot of my internal process around that. And then Ralph, which is the boy that I worked with in juvenile detention. And his story runs through most of the book as well. Even though he was a patient that has not taken place during this 9-year period. So I'm reflecting back and thinking about Ralph. So the story about Ralph runs throughout the book because I'm reflecting on how I feel about him because he was raised by prostitutes. Mm-hmm. And that's why it comes up for me, because I'm very angry at social stigmas associated with prostitution and how people define people based on something that they do rather than who they are. And here are these three amazing women who took Ralph off the street when his family abandoned him and raised him. And him and I meet when he's in juvenile detention. That story to me is compelling. He's killed people, but he's an extremely, talk about what you need in a fictional character.
Yeah.
I think he's a prototype, right? Because he has done something so that there's like conflict,
mm-hmm.
both for him and for myself. But there's also a resolution, I think, that can be very satisfying, so you can empathize with him too. At first I was like worried about how, because I worry about everything, quite honestly. I'm, you know, pretty neurotic in that way, but I was worried that, you know, my feelings for him could be misconstrued by my readers. Like, here I am so worried and so invested in this boy who's, you know, a gang member and has killed people. He's disclosed this to me. But the people that have read it, that have talked to us about it, said that they felt the same sense of empathy I had, because he's not really an evil person. There were reasons that led to that, and I'm not excusing his behavior, but we get to see so much humanity in Ralph that it's hard not to empathize with his story.
Wow.
So I hate to say I have a favorite, because they were all my patients, or some still are, and but I'm just thinking in terms of the what's compelling.
Fantastic. So yeah. If people are looking to find more information about you or your book, where can they do so?
Well, they can find it on Amazon.com.
Okay.
It's Bear. Psychotherapy Stripped. And BarnesandNoble.com. And what's your...
Do you guys have a website?
Yeah, I have a website. It's DrJacquelineGunn.com. Okay.
And we'll put up a link to that on the website so you guys can find it.
And we'll have a Facebook page too.
Fantastic.
Bear Psychotherapy Strip.
Great.
Amazing. Thank you.
I was going to ask if you guys are going to be doing any events or anything that you wanted to mention.
We don't have anything else planned right now.
We're
working on it. We don't have anything else set in stone yet.
All right, sorry.
Okay, so thank you so much for coming in today. It was wonderful having you. It was fascinating. Everybody, please go and get this book.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Hey You Know It. Stay in touch with us during the week. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Tumblr. Go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on an upcoming show, regardless of content.
And we'll send you an official Hey You Know It shot glass as a token of our appreciation. As always, we love your emails. Send us an email at heyyouknowit@gmail.com with your comments, questions, and segment ideas. Emails will also be read on upcoming shows, and yes, you will receive an official Hey You Know It shot glass as well.
Please tell your friends about us, because you know we don't advertise, and let them know we can be found on iTunes, at Stitcher.com, and at heyyouknowit.com. Thanks!